calm herself. Even though the snow is moving, and she is moving, it's all like an icy dream from which life has fled. She could look down on herself and watch herself struggling on, an insect which doesn't know that it's winter and it shouldn't be out. It's quite funny when you look down on yourself like that. There's life in the Sanaya market. It has become the crossroads where those who have meet those who want. Those who want bring their jewels, rolls of paper rubles, icons, silver knives and forks, velvet dresses, rolled up canvases cut from paintings, Venetian glass wrapped in layers of woolen cloth, war medals and porcelain plates. Journey by journey they bring the accumulated wealth of several lifetimes. On each journey they get less back for it. The prices are never fixed. Here, the laws of supply and demand apply in their purest form. A woman who possesses lard, bread, oil, or a scrap of bacon can set them against whatever her heart desires. If she has a jar of sugar, she can cover herself with rubies. The market operates with ruthless force, inflating its prices day by day, and sometimes hour by hour. As Anna moves close to the stalls, she sees a stallholder flip an offered gold locket with his finger. He has bread to sell.
I'll give you 100 grams for it, that's all. Take it or leave it.
But it's worth...
Take it home and eat it, then.
And he turns huge, bored shoulders on the trembling woman, whose locket has slipped through her fingers into the snow. No one says...
I'll sell you this bread.
They say...
I'll give you this bread.
The brutal truth is that before the Tsar of bread, everything else must sink to its knees. Everyone knows it.
Your jewels? Your father's life savings? Can you eat them?
No.
What use are all your possessions if you haven't got the means to keep life in your body? Hand over everything, and I might give you life for another half a day.
Everyone now knows what it takes to keep life in a body. You can be separated from your life so easily. It might happen in the street, or in the bread queue, while you're typing... or while you're sleeping. You can die from a cold, an ear infection, or a miscarriage. If you have a stomach ulcer, it will open and bleed. You can die so casually these days.
The stallholder attends to another customer, while the woman with the locket grovels at his feet, scrabbling for gold in the snow.
When she holds it out to him again, submissively this time, he simply nods, pockets it, and hands her a little chunk of bread. She stares round, unfastens coat and jacket, and thrusts the bread into her blouse. Then she stands still for a moment, as if she's forgotten where she is and what she's doing. Her blue-tinged face is vacant.
She's a goner, Anna thinks,
making the rapid, automatic assessment she's learned in the past few weeks. Anna skirts the stalls, making eye contact with no one. Her cotton bag of bread, lard and sugar bumps against her waist. She is sure that others can see the bulge it makes in her coat, and so she hunches forward, walking more slowly than ever, hiding herself in the shroud of falling snow. She hasn't yet seen any bujwiki for sale.
3 men stand guard over a stall where a few small pots of meat pate are on display.
She walks on, lowering her eyes, dragging the empty sledge, which hurts her arms as much as if Kolya and 2 of his friends were packed onto it and she were pulling them uphill. For a moment she almost believes they are there behind her. Kolya, Alyosha and Shura, squeaking and giggling, their cheeks burning crimson with frost and health, their plump little legs encased in winter trousers and felt boots.
"Please, Anna, please, just give us 1 more turn!"
But her empty sledge sticks in a snowdrift, shudders, and then comes free.
Anna!
My God, Evgenia, you frightened me!
I saw you by Lavra's stall. Don't go near there again, he's dangerous.
Who's Lavra?
Don't look. The one with the meat. What are you doing down here, anyway?
I'm looking for a bujwika. Evgenia glances at the empty sledge, then at Anna's empty arms.
Got the price? I won't take money, you know.
I've got it.
Come with me. I know the woman who trades them. She had 2 last time I went by.
Her name's Galia.
Not that she'll want you to know her name. But she knows me. She don't want to get in wrong with me in case things turn out different from expectations.
What do you mean?
Galia's canny enough to realise that we might not all die. She's done all right out of the war so far, but the customers she's screwed into the ground won't forget her, if any of them are still alive, that is. The only thing people like her are afraid of is life returning to normal. She knows I'll be back to see her, unless she treats me right. I'm not going to die.
They're standing very close, but even so flakes of snow are falling between them. Yevgenia's red hair is wound up in a thick shawl. The planes of her face are flattened by hunger, and her freckles stand out yellowly. In normal times you'd say that she looked terrible. You'd ask her what was the matter, and what she was doing out of bed. But Anna believes her. Yevgenia will live and not die.
Is your kid all right?
He's at home.
You keep him there, Anna. Don't let him out. The streets round here aren't safe for kids. Let's go and get that stove.
The woman with the bouzhouiki is tucked away, standing in the shadow of a wall. As Yevgenia and Anna approach, she glances round, darting her head this way and that with a strange, inhuman movement.
Looking for a bloke. A minder. She got set on the other day when she wouldn't sell for a kilo of bread.
Do you come here a lot?
I'm here most days, says Yevgenia. Here, Galia. This is a friend of mine. She wants a stove and a stovepipe. She don't want any of your rubbish, either.
Stoves and stovepipes are sold separately, chants the woman, staring at Anna with flat, expressionless eyes.
Then she retracts her head into the folds of her scarf. She's a lizard. That's what she is, Anna realises. Lizards are cold-blooded.
Not to me and my friends, they aren't, says Yevgenia.
What's she got?
I've got a kilo bag of sugar, begins Anna, when a shove from Yevgenia silences her.
My friend will give you the sugar for the stove and the stovepipe.
The stove seller just shrugs.
Don't make me laugh. I could get twice that. These bouzhouiki are like gold dust these days.
You could, but it wouldn't do you any good, says Yevgenia quietly.
What are you saying? Are you threatening me?
Piotr, come over here.
I'm not threatening anyone. We're neighbours, aren't we? Good neighbours.
And we want to go on being neighbours.
Neighbours have got to sort things out themselves, haven't they? We can't always be running off to the authorities or our lives won't be worth living.
Did you know, Anna, they aren't bothering with arrests or trials or any of that stuff now? Anyone who looks like a speculator, they just get shot. Stopped on the street, open your bag, and if you've got stuff in there you shouldn't have, that's it, you're a speculator. No more questions. Bang.
Galia knows that,
don't you, Galia? Neighbours need to stick together in times like this. We've all got to help each other, that's the way it goes. Yevgenia speaks so quietly that Pyotr, hulking outside the little cluster of women, can't hear a word.
A kilo of sugar and 3 days' bread ration, says Galia rapidly.
Her tongue flicks over her lips.
I'm giving it to you.
Anna half turns, so the stove seller won't see the contents of her bag when she opens it. She extracts the sugar and bread and pushes the rest of the stuff to the bottom of the bag.
Give us the stove first, says Yevgenia.
The woman reaches down and pulls out a stove from under the stall.
Where's the stovepipe?
Here.
That section's cracked. Do you want to poison her?
Most of those I sell to don't even buy a pipe.
My friend's buying a pipe. One with 4 sections. The other one, the one you've got tucked away behind the stall, the one that's not cracked. That's the one she's paying you for.
Grumbling, Galia crouches down and ferrets out a second stovepipe.
Get it onto the sledge, Anna.
I want my payment first.
You'll get your payment when my friend's got her stove fixed on her sledge.
Yevgenia stands over Anna, arms folded over the sugar and bread, while Anna packs sections of stovepipe beside the squat body of the stove. She wraps her torn sheet over stove and stovepipe and ties it down with her strips of hem.
You ready now, Anna?
Yes.
All right then, Galia. There's your sugar and there's your bread.
Mind out for those patrols on your way home.
They don't think any more of shooting a speculator than shooting a pigeon.
There aren't any pigeons around anymore because they've all been eaten. And there's plenty of speculators. Not many as nice and plump as you, though, are there, Gallia? Maybe we can eat speculators for a change. We could have a little chat with Lavra about it. Gallia's head darts out of its collar. She looks as if she's going to hiss like a lizard. Watch what you're saying, she mutters, almost inaudibly. I know what I'm saying, says Yevgenia, and so do you. You mind what I say, Gallia. Bang! Side by side, Yevgenia and Anna walk across the market. The stove feels heavy, but already snow is falling onto the sheets that cover it, disguising it.
You better get off home quick, says Yevgenia.
Yevgenia, here! Anna fumbles with the flap of her bag and gets out the lard and the 500 rubles. You have this. I'd never have got the stove without you. Yevgenia takes the lard and tucks it into her coat pocket.
I don't need the money, she says.
Yevgenia, how's your mother and your little boy?
Oh, he's had this same cough everyone's had. Mum bought some cod liver oil for him, but it's all gone. There's nothing else wrong with him once he gets rid of his cough. Only hunger.
If that woman had been on her own, I'd have taken the stove, knocked her into the snow and run.
Yeah, I reckon she knows that. That's why she keeps Piotr close at hand. She has to give him a cut, of course, but I should say he's worth it. If even a nice girl like you is thinking of bashing Gallia over the head and running off with her stoves, there'll be plenty who'd do much more than think about it. Me for a kick-off.
Have you got a bushwicker?
I got one off Gallia 2 weeks ago, when it turned cold.
So you're doing all right? I mean, you've got money. You're still working.
I got my job, though the power's been off so much we're only on about 20% production. I'm still on a worker's ration, which is the main thing. But I'm working with my left hand as well.
Where?
You know, down a market.
Oh, I see.
Quick, aren't you? Mind you, they say hunger slows down the brain. 200 grams is the going rate at the moment. You can guess what type of man has 200 grams to spare these days. They're a real portrait gallery. But I'm not much of a one for men anyway, as you know, so it doesn't make a lot of difference to me. Whereas bread does. And I don't really.
Just for a moment, Yevgenia's tone falters.
And I don't really notice it at all. Do you ever get that feeling, Anna, as if things won't still be there when you reach out to touch them?
Yes.
It's lack of vitamins, that's what it is. We're suffering from what polar explorers get. Only we're not going to discover anything, except that if you don't eat, you end up dead. When I was short for the stove, Gallia found me a bloke with a thing about red hair. So, she's not all bad, is she? Even though I agree that she'd be a lot better looking arse over tipping a snowdrift.
We'll fix that up for her one day, shall we?
Just wait till all this is over. The German bastards will be running in one direction and those Sanaya bastards in the other. There'll be some arses kicked then, I can tell you. But listen, Anna, don't you even think about going in for what I'm doing. Shits like Piotr will mince you up in a week if you don't know how to deal with them. And you don't. Anyone can see that. You get home with that stove. I'll see you again. On the patriotic day of workers' arse kicking, if not before.
Yevgenia's strong teeth gleam in her pallid face. Then she turns and is swallowed up in the falling snow. It takes a long time to walk home. Already the temperature is dropping again. Tomorrow there'll be a glossy crust of ice on blue mounds of fresh snow. No one is clearing the streets. There's no sign of the old women with their brooms who should be out by now sweeping the doorsteps and the strip of pavement in front of their apartment houses. They haven't got the strength to come out. They're huddled in their apartments, which have turned into cells of ice. They sit in hats and boots, gloves, shawls and coats, with their blankets piled over them. And they are cold. Anna trudges past a building where an old woman has lain with flu for a week. She lies alone, although at her side there is a half-drunk glass of tea made for her by a neighbour the day before. But now the neighbour is ill herself and cannot come. There's ice on the tea. As Anna passes, and as day wheels round into night, the old woman's lungs cease to resist the secondary infection which she has been holding off for the past 24 hours. Pneumonia takes hold, although the old woman feels nothing much, except that she is very weak. In the centre of each grey, seamed cheek, there is a small, purplish-red spot. It hurts to breathe deeply, so she breathes in shallow pants, sipping the icy air into her body.
"Mama, please light the stove," she begs.
Pain comes alive in her body, penetrating every grain of her flesh. Slowly and painfully she begins to rock herself from side to side, in the rhythm of her mother's heartbeat. It consoled her 70 years ago when she was in the womb. It consoles her now. She rocks and rocks, sipping in breath. Soon it will be better. The aching will go away, and she won't shiver any more once her temperature rises. She will burn for a while, and then she'll die down. There are no sounds in the cold little room but the sounds she makes. Once, very faintly, she hears the flop of new, unstable snow falling from the roof into the courtyard, but she thinks it is something else. The ice on her half-drunk glass of tea grows thicker. By the time she gets to the Moika, Anna is seeing people who aren't there again. A group of students, arm in arm, the girls in short-sleeved summer dresses, crosses the bridge. They laugh. They look down at the sparkling water. Anna hears their voices ring over the canal, bright with summer happiness. Where are they going? And why so happy? She drops the rope of the sledge and strains to see where they've gone. But they have disappeared. It's not snowing so heavily now. Immediately below her on the ice, there's an old woman crouching, drilling a hole with the kind of hand drill ice fishermen use. Perhaps she's going to fish. No, there's a bucket beside her on the ice. She's come for water. She ought to go down to the Nevar. The water will be purer there. But perhaps it's too far. Anna listens to the squeak of drill on ice. As if the woman senses her presence, she glances up and sees Anna leaning on the canal wall. Recognition passes between them. Anna knows the old woman, because she was at school with her. "Tanya," she calls. "Is that you?"
"Yes, it's me. How are you all?"
"All well. What about you?" "Your brother, Seryozha, the handsome one. Your little sister, Masha, with her pulled-back hair and startlingly deep blue eyes, who played the piano so well."
"Masha was evacuated. Seryozha's in the army. It's just me at home, with my mother."
"The water's gone in your apartment, then?"
"Yes, all the pipes are frozen. Even the courtyard pipe now. There was a man who came round with a cart and you could buy water, but he doesn't come any more. You've still got water?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'd better get on."
But Tanya doesn't start drilling again. She stares at Anna, her dark eyes hungry in her drawn, sexless face. Starvation has catapulted her into old age. She used to complain that it was so unfair, the way Masha had those beautiful eyes while her own were a sort of grey, nothing special. But Tanya's eyes seem to have grown larger, carving out pools of darkness in her face. Suddenly she looks a long way down, like someone at the bottom of a cliff. Will she ever be able to climb back up those steps from the canal ice? Anna picks up the sledge rope.
"See you again."
"Yes. Good luck."
"Good luck."
The sky flares briefly into sunset as Anna trudges on. The snow burns blue and crimson. Then the light dies. There are only a few wild-looking streaks of red left in the sky. And over there, that red that burns more fiercely, it must be a fire started by German shells. They're using phosphorus incendiaries. Because there is no water to put the fires out, they burn until they die of their own accord. The wind is rising, though it's not fierce yet. It burns Anna's face as she makes her way onward, back bent, dragging the heavy sledge. Only a few hundred meters now. Soon she'll be home. They'll have to help her carry the stove upstairs, piece by piece. She can't do it on her own. She just can't do all those journeys up and down the stairs on top of this. Maybe Marina will be able to manage the sections of stovepipe, one at a time, if Anna carries the stove itself. But Marina's so weak. Anna stops. She looks up at the sky, and fine icy snow patters into her face. Her legs shake. Is it just the snow falling, or is she losing her balance? She clenches the rope. She's still standing. She won't fall. She'll make it to the corner, then to the first lamppost, then the next. An explosion tears through her. She doubles up, dropping the rope. She's down in the snow, on all fours, like an animal. Slowly, realizing herself, she clambers up. It wasn't close. It's all right. Blood beats hard in her head as the shock spreads through her flesh. She bends down slowly and picks up the loop of rope. It's all right. It wasn't close. Just the usual shelling, pounding from the southwest. Bastards, says Anna. Bastards, bastards, bastards. Last month, they shelled the department where her mother worked. But all the equipment Vera had fought for was saved, because it had already been moved into the cellars. Kamarovsky told Anna about it when she met him one day, crossing the Anichkov Bridge. He said things were difficult, but they were still able to carry on. How's everyone?
We're managing. We have to improvise. There's no chance of getting spare parts, and of course there's a shortage of trained personnel. So many away sick. But we keep going. I often think of your mother.
She will get this sledge home. She will get the stove upstairs and light it. She will make sure that Kolya does his breathing exercises. She will put food in his mouth, whatever it takes. Nothing is going to stop her.
Bastards, she shouts at the grey sky. I don't care what you do. You can all go and fuck yourselves, you fucking bastards. See if I care.
Chapter 19. Kolya kneels by the stove. Yellow light flickers on his face as he touches his lighted taper to a curl of newsprint. His breathing is heavy with responsibility. Hold it there. Wait till it catches. Kolya holds the taper still. A blue skim of flame races over the paper and deepens to yellow.
It's lit! It's lit! It's on fire!
He turns round to Anna, his face triumphant.
I lit it properly, didn't I, Anna?
Flame burrows deep into the coils of Leningradskaya Pravda with which Anna has packed the stove. Among these coils is the front page from one of the worst days of the September bombardment.
Leningrad, to be or not to be? It asks.
Her father had stared at that headline for a long time when the paper came out. On that day, he didn't have the energy to read the article, but he folded the newspaper and kept it by his bed. From time to time, he reached out and touched the headline.
Leningrad, he muttered. And we're asking if it will be or not be.
After a few days, she had taken away the newspaper, and he hadn't seemed to notice. She thought she would keep it, and she folded it inside her father's copy of Oblomov. One day, when all this was over, she would show it to Kolya.
But now, everything that can burn must be burned. Flame crackles at the handful of splintery wood from a chopped-up packing case.
Kolya kneels there, swallowing the warmth of the fire like food. He's taken off his gloves and spread his hands to the heat. How thin they are now. Not like Kolya's hands at all. They look older and more knowing than they should, now that the rosy flesh has disappeared. So does his face, with its sharp little nose and big eyes.
Now he knows what grown-ups can't do. You can ask for food, but they won't give you any.
I'm hungry, Anna. My stomach hurts.
Let me rub it for you.
I don't want you to rub me. I want some sausage.
There isn't any sausage, Gulia.
Why?
Her face is tight when she looks at him. Is she angry? Is she cross with him? He grizzles to wear her down.
I'm hungry, Anna. I'm so hungry. My stomach hurts.
She pulls him onto her knee. She rocks him, too tight and too hard. She doesn't go into the kitchen and open the cupboard and get food for him. He doesn't ask any more. His hair is dry and dull under the fur cap, which she keeps pulling forward to make sure his ears are covered. His hair needs cutting. Wisps of it stick out from under his cap. He crouches there like a cave boy, worshipping flame.
We've got loads of stuff we can burn, haven't we, Anna?
Yes, loads of stuff. The crackle and hiss of flame is life in the cold room.
You will live, it says. You will live and not die.
Once the Bujrika gets going, its fuel will be their mother's oak dressing table. It's a solid, well-made piece, which will give hours of heat. Anna swallows the sudden memory of Vera at her dressing table, twisting up her heavy, dark brown hair and pinning it at the nape of her neck. The hair was newly washed and slippery. Her mother made an impatient sound, dipped her fingers in a jug of water, then damped her hair. Anna leaned forward and smelled her mother. She smelled her mother's warm skin and the rosemary rinse she used on her hair to make it shine. Vera's face stared at itself in the mirror, but Anna knew she was thinking about something quite different.
Mama, you look prettier when you don't bunch up your hair like that.
It wouldn't be practical, Anna. Vera was already thinking of her work. There she glowed with life. There she had her team, her responsibilities, her patience. There was always some problem to be solved or new technique to be explored. At work, Anna saw. Her mother laughed. There were jokes which flickered over Anna's head, and she basked in them without understanding them. Vera's colleagues knew everything about Anna, and they'd brought in cakes because she was coming. Vera explained the work of the radiology department to Anna, drawing diagrams and showing Anna the machines. This is why you have to work hard at your maths, so that when you're grown up, you can get a job you love. Love was a rare word in her mother's mouth. She praised Anna for what she did, rather than for what she was. Suddenly, she placed her hand on Anna's hair. I want you to have this. I want you to have work that makes you happy. It's especially important for you because you're going to be a woman. You'll need something that is your own. I want you to keep studying hard until you fulfill your potential. And here I am, thinks Anna, contemplating the well-made joints of the dressing table. And your dressing table's about to fulfill its potential by keeping us warm for a couple of days. She feels a perverse, angry desire for her mother to see this. Maybe I haven't fulfilled my potential, Mammy, but watch how I'll keep us alive. She wanted me to have something that was mine and didn't depend on anyone else. She turned round on her stool, away from her mirrored image. She put her hands on either side of my face and pushed my hair back and looked into my eyes. She was half smiling. Work is what keeps you going, Anna. If only Anna had thought to bring the axe from the dacha. They have a tiny chopper in the apartment, but it won't cut anything much thicker than the packing case. They are borrowing a saw from the Sergeyevs across the landing, but this means that Anna has had to offer them a share in the wood. Zina didn't want to take it at first.
No, go on, we're not using the saw today anyway.
The Sergeyevs have no bujuika, but they have rigged up a lethal little brick fireplace close to their ventilation window.
There's no fire risk, Zina assured Anna. You see, there's a layer of stones under the brick, and my Fedya's put a sheet of steel underneath that.
But Fedya's hardly ever at home now. He works, sleeps, and eats at the Kirov works.
My Fedya's a wonderful worker. Practically a Stakhanovite, Zina said to Anna once, not long after her marriage.
Fedya won't speak to Anna if he meets her on the stairway or in the queue for the bathroom. He's a big, solid, handsome man, fair-haired and strongly muscled, a real Leningrad boy who grew up in the courtyard with his mate. His mother hung out of the window to yell him in for supper, like all the other mothers. Echoes, screams, whistles, shouts, smells of cabbage and soup. Anna sees him in singlet and trousers on the bathroom landing, with his towel slung over his shoulder. He pushes his way into the bathroom first, because he's got to get going, down to the Kirov works. He's got a real man's job. But he's decent, too, the kind who would do anything for you, if he was on your side. Fedya's a party member, the real thing. When he sees any member of the Levin family, his face closes over. He doesn't trust them, doesn't like them being in the building, and certainly doesn't want them on his landing. The Levins are trouble. "We were living here when you were just a kid," she wants to tell him. But he swings his way down the stairs, whistling proprietorial, and she says nothing. There's nothing to be said to this young man in his prime, a respected worker with a wife and child who has done everything right and has very little sense of humour. What can you say to him that will change his mind when he believes so absolutely in what he is and what he does? By definition, his thoughts become truths. He knows that if there are enemies of the people still waiting to be unmasked, then they will behave exactly like Anna's family, coming in and out at odd times, reading books in the bathroom, smiling when there is no reason to smile, and possessing two whole rooms and a kitchen. Fedya certainly believes that enemies of the people exist. He reads his paper thoroughly and scans the staring little photographs of engineers and university lecturers who've been unmasked as spies, Trotskyites, and saboteurs. They thought they'd fooled him, did they? Well, look at them now, and a good thing too. Yes, when she passes Fedya on the stairs, Anna can see in his face the thought of their two-room apartment and her own unworthiness to live in it when a whole raft of decent workers could be put in there. And how he'd love that, she thinks. But there's a shamefully weak part of her that still wants Fedya to like her, even though she knows that he never will. What a fool she is! She remembers the time when she was standing aside in the hallway, waiting while he helped old Masha downstairs with her kerosene. When he saw Anna, he shot her an unfriendly look, as if to say, "What are you hanging about for?" Why did that look burn her? She'd wanted to spread out her arms, barring the stairs, and not let him go by until she'd told him, "I work too, you know. I'm a nursery assistant, and I've got more bums and noses to wipe than you've seen in your entire life. And I'm bringing up a child as well." But it wouldn't make the slightest difference. He knows her origins. She's the daughter of a member of the intelligentsia, and a dodgy one at that. No amount of toilet scrubbing will get rid of that stain. In spite of Fedya's fireplace, the Sergeyev's room is as cold as a tomb. Theirs is a single room, but the biggest on the landing, and it faces north. "Why don't you come into us, you and the baby?" Anna suggests. "Once we've got the Bujawika going, it'll be a lot warmer than in here." But Zina shrinks back. "Oh, no, thank you, we're fine as we are. With our little fire, it gets quite warm." She wouldn't dare come into their apartment. What would her Fedya say? He's always telling her that she's politically naive. She can't help it, he knows, because of her lack of education, so he's undertaken to keep her on the right tracks. The trouble is that the tracks seem to keep swerving all over the place and then doubling back on themselves. Zina's given up trying to work out where these tracks are going. Although she looks and listens and nods in all the right places, really she has switched off. But Fedya has dinned into her that the Levins are not safe neighbours. It's one thing to meet on the stairway, but she mustn't take it any further. "You see, Zina, with people like that you get drawn in. They seem friendly enough, but that shows how artful they are. And of course you're judged by who you associate with. That's only natural." She knows that Fedya would go mad if he knew she'd been into the Levins' apartment. Quite apart from questions of right or wrong, or political education, you can't be sure who might be watching you. Even now, when you'd think people would have enough to do with trying to find the next meal, there might be someone with enough energy to denounce you. There's one in every apartment building. The baby writhes in her arms. Its head wobbles on scrawny folds of neck as it lets out a mew and butts feebly against Zina's clothes. "He's hungry," she says to Anna. "Are you still feeding him yourself?"
Yes, but I don't know if he's getting enough. Can you remember what your collier weighed at 3 months?
About 8 kilos, I think.
He only weighs 4.5. And he was such a big baby when he was born, do you remember?
Yes, he was.
Let me have a look. Gently, Anna draws back the shawl. The baby's hands are crossed on his chest. They are purplish and spider-thin, like the hands of a newborn. She touches the baby's cheek. He's suffering from dehydration as well as malnutrition. Is he drinking water?
No.
You could boil a little on your fire and let it cool. Have you got any sugar?
No.
Anna touches the baby's cheek again. Or honey? Anything sweet?
We haven't got anything.
But to put sugar into this baby's mouth is to take it out of Colias. The baby mews again, its old small face screwing up. Its mouth works against the palm of Anna's hand, rooting for food. She'll give Colia an extra share of her own bread ration to make up. Sina, I can let you have 100 grams of sugar. Have you got a baby's bottle? Sina nods.
I got one when he was born, but I've never used it.
Sina doesn't seem surprised or grateful at Anna's offer of the sugar. She doesn't, in fact, seem to understand what it means. Boil up the water and quarter fill the bottle. While the water's still hot, add a teaspoon of the sugar so it dissolves. Then give him that every hour, even if you have to rouse him. If he doesn't suck at first, put the water on your finger until he gets the taste of it, and then he'll suck.
But he's sleeping so well. He's sleeping right through the night now.
That's because he's so weak. He shouldn't be sleeping like that. You have to rouse him. Flick the soles of his feet with your fingers if he won't wake. Like this. Once he's got a bit of energy, he'll start to suck more strongly. The stronger he sucks, the more milk you will make. And you must rest all you can. Wrap yourself up in everything you've got and drink plenty of water. You'll make more milk if you conserve your energy. Sina is only 19. 4 years younger than Anna, and not even a Leningrader. She's got no family here. And now she's landed up in the middle of all this, and with the baby, too. Sina's a Kiev girl, and she hasn't seen her mother since the baby was born. Her dark eyes fix intently on Anna's face.
Anna Mikhailovna, tell me, she whispers. When are they going to lift the blockade?
I don't know. But Zina's eyes continue to search her face.
Doesn't your father know anything? He's a writer, isn't he?
We don't know anything. How could we? Sina asks no more, though Anna can tell she wants to. Maybe she really believes that there is a layer of people left in Leningrad which is in control of what is happening and knows what's coming. Maybe it's less frightening if you believe that. And whether her father comes into that category because he's a writer or because Fedya's told her he might be a German sympathiser, Anna can't guess. But she's still angry, even though there is no point in being angry with Sina. My father was wounded defending the motherland. He can't even get out of bed, she says. How do you think he can possibly know anything? How strange to hear herself talking of the motherland, using words that belong on posters, not in real life. And yet she means it. Words are regaining their meanings after years of masquerade. Hunger means hunger. Terror means terror. Enemy means enemy. It's not like trying to read mirror writing anymore. Everything gets clearer day by day as siege and winter eat into their lives. The coils of Soviet life are losing their strength. There's only the present left, and it has burned away both past and future. There's only the dark, besieged, freezing city and the Germans outside, dug into their winter positions, waiting, stamping their feet. But they will never come in. Her friend in the party was right. We will destroy everything. We will blow up our own city and let it burn as we let Moscow burn before Napoleon. We've mined bridges, steelworks, palaces and power stations. If we have to, we'll press the buttons that detonate those fuses. Once Anna saw an apartment building dynamited, because it was in the way of a new road. In the second of detonation, it hung in the air, silent, holding shape like a mirage of itself. Then the noise of the blast rolled over it and flattened it. We will do that. We will eat horses and pigeons and dogs. We will burn our books and our furniture. We will consume ourselves rather than be consumed.
I'm sorry, Anna Mikhailovna. I didn't mean anything.
She's terrified I won't give her the sugar now. No, it's more than that. She really is sorry. I have got to stop being so suspicious of everyone. I'll go and get that sugar. And thanks again for letting us use your axe. I'll bring you your share of the wood once we've finished chopping up the dressing table.
A dressing table?
How nice. I've always wanted one of those. It was my mother's. At the thought of the dressing table, Zina's eyes fill for the first time with tears of weakness.
It doesn't seem right, does it, all this?
You go and lie down. When I come back with the sugar, I'll knock on the door twice, so you know it's me. Tuck him in beside you and open the shawl so he gets the warmth of your body. They can't maintain their body temperature as we can.
She sounds like Fedya, thinks Zina. So sure of herself and knowing things and having the right words. But it's different with Anna, because I can understand what she says. I don't keep drifting off.
In the apartment, the buzhuika is burning strongly, eating up Anna's school books.
It's getting hot,
shouts Kolya as she comes into the room. Her father is on the sofa, swaddled in blankets. On the floor, Marina has pushed together the big mattress and Kolya's little mattress. She's busy heaping them with blankets, pillows and shawls. In the light of the candle stub, huge shadows of Marina leap from wall to wall. It is 5 o'clock. Anna goes to the kitchen with a spill of paper lit from the candle, lights another stub, and opens the store cupboard. There's the last bag of sugar. Without allowing herself to think about what she's doing, she opens it carefully and measures 100 grams into a cup.
What are you doing?
Oh, Marina, you nearly made me spill it. I'm just measuring some sugar.
For whom?
Marina raps out.
For the baby next door. Zina's baby. He's starving.
Marina is silent while Anna refolds the top of the sugar bag. Then she says, with cold certainty,
You can't do that.
I've got to. He's malnourished and he's dehydrated. In this cold he could easily die.
Marina draws herself up.
So what are you going to do about it, Anna? What about all those other babies? Are you going to trawl up and down the street, knocking on doors until you've given away all our food to people who are going to die? And then you can come home and watch Kolya die.
It's only 100 grams.
100 grams is 100 grams. It's not only anything.
But Zina's our neighbour. We can hear the baby crying.
She's only across the landing and she hasn't got a clue what to do. He's going to go to sleep and not wake up at all if he doesn't get some calories into his body soon.
Marina lays her hand on Anna's arm. Her voice changes, taking on a seductive, vibrant cello note that Anna has not heard before.
Anna, she says, you are the ones who matter. You and Kolya. Don't you understand that?
Only us.
You still don't see, do you, what it's going to be like? You still don't understand. It's going to go on like this, getting colder and colder, and with less and less food. No one's going to come and help us. And I don't intend to watch you all die.
You might die first.
A grin stretches her face. She can't really be standing here with Marina talking about their own deaths. She can't really want to burst out laughing.
People don't die just when they want to.
I'm the type who'll go on to the end.
It's pure selfishness, you're quite right. I can't face seeing you die one by one before me.
So put the sugar back in the bag.
Marina's eyes glow in the light of the candle stub. Anna can't read them, but they draw her in. She wants, suddenly more than anything, to yield and become what Marina wants. She wants to be carried on the warm wave of Marina's voice, to let Marina decide. They're almost touching in the tiny space of the kitchen. She wants to give in, and Marina knows it. It's like sex. The other person always knows. But the baby cries. In spite of his weakness, the cry is piercing. It is like Kolya's cry. She would get up in the night to him, sick with tiredness those first days after Vera died. She didn't know the first thing about babies then. No, says Anna, with stiff, clumsy lips. I can't do that. I've told Zina she can have 100 grams. But that'll be the end of it. She'll have to manage on her own after this. Everything else is for Kolya. Marina has drawn back. It's over.
Even if she comes knocking on the door with that baby?
Even if she does.
Good. Because you have a responsibility, you know.
To what? Anna is sure she knows the answer. Marina will say that her responsibility is to Kolya and to her father. But she doesn't. Instead, she looks closely at Anna and says,
"To stay alive, of course."
To what? Thinks Anna later, when the sugar is gone and the candle is burning down. But the bourgeoisie really does give out some heat now that she's been able to feed it with wood. Kolya's looking better already. And tomorrow she'll attack the other half of the dressing table. She couldn't do it all at once. The effort of chopping the wood made her heart beat so fast that she thought she would vomit. Marina made her sit down and take valerian drops. She is drawing. Kolya is asleep, curled on his mattress close to the stove. Anna has a stick of willow charcoal, and she is drawing Marina as she sits by the sofa, reading to Anna's father.
A responsibility. But to what?
Thinks Anna again. What did Marina really mean? To stay alive is not enough if everything else has gone. She's right about that.
I should have waited and helped Tanya to climb the canal steps, but I couldn't do it. I had to get home and carry the stove upstairs.
Her father lies still with his eyes closed, but Anna knows he is awake. Marina is reading a Shakespeare play in English, which she speaks better than any of them. It is A Winter's Tale. Anna can understand some of it, but she's not really listening. She has cut out the too seductive sound of Marina's voice so that she can draw. Her fingers are clumsy with cold, even though she's wearing a pair of old woolen gloves. Their tips are cut off because she can't draw with gloved fingers. She draws with long, firm strokes. Tonight, the charcoal seems not just to sweep the paper, but to understand every grain of it. How strange it is that she should be drawing Marina's portrait now. Marina's face is so much changed, or maybe it's Anna's perception which has changed. Marina does not look beautiful. Her glasses perch on her nose, and she wrinkles up her eyes to focus on the text in the poor light of the candle. Her eyes are watering. Anna knows she's worried about her eyesight. From time to time, she stops reading and fixes Anna's father with a long look, as ruthlessly protective as the stare of a hawk circling its nest, scouring the sky for danger to its young. She loves him.
Of course she does. It's as simple as that. She has loved him in this way, and he has loved her in another.
She is his dear and brilliant friend, of whom he has always been very slightly afraid.
But she loves him.
It's been going on for years, nearly 20 years, way back before Golia's birth, back to when Marina tried to make herself into a dear friend of their mother's, too. But Vera wouldn't let her. Vera refused to be party to any of it. She would never collude. How strange it all is. How painful and lopsided. But when you look at Marina, you can't help believing that this is the only way she could ever have loved. There would always have to be something impossible at the core of it. And I would never have known about it if it hadn't been for all this. She would have remained my father's old friend. Wonderful actress. Beautiful, too, you know, in her time. You should have seen her, but of course these days. I would never have folded blankets with her, hand to hand. I would have drawn her portrait at her dacha and never known her at all.
It has got to be a double portrait. Her father and Marina.
Rapidly, Anna sketches the sofa, the outline of her father's body blurred by its pile of covers, the sharp edges of nose and jaw, the sunken hollows of his eyes. She draws his protruding eyeballs with the veined skin of his eyelids sealed down over them. She draws the angle of Marina's neck as she fixes her gaze on him again. The poise of that head closes a circle, which contains only Marina and the man lying on the sofa. One hand holds the pages of her Shakespeare, the other rests on the pillow, close to his shrunken cheek.
Anna draws on.
She shapes the pointed shadows that spring out on the wall behind Marina. She draws the patchwork blanket, which is drawn up under her father's chin. She knitted that blanket herself, coloured square by coloured square, before Kolya was born. It wrapped him on his first outing. Her fingers remember the warmth and scratchiness of the wools. It was spring and cold. She held Kolya awkwardly, not yet used to him, as she walked in the park. The black buds were swollen, bursting with leaf. The baby screwed up his eyes against the strong spring light. She draws on. The stove sighs as a lump of wood collapses into ash. Soon its warmth will be gone, quickly. Quickly, before her fingers stiffen, she draws her father's jawbone. Only Anna hears two taps at the outer door. She gets up, putting her drawing aside. It can't be Andrei, because he's already said he won't be able to come tonight. Perhaps it's Zina. Something wrong with the baby again. But it's Andrei, pale, with soot marks on his face.
What's happened? That crazy idiot Boria made a fire in our apartment, and then he fell asleep and it went through to the floorboards. They managed to put it out, but the smoke's wrecked everything. Both mattresses caught fire.
Oh, my God! Is Boria all right?
He's inhaled smoke, so he's not feeling too good, but he'll survive. The Antonovs will take him in.
He didn't lose his ration card?
No.
Without a ration card, you die for certain. It's as simple as that. With one, you may die too, but the land of not dying remains open to you. Andrei stares down at her with his Siberian eyes. Even when he's as kicked in as he is now, he still seems to bring with him the taste of a different, more open-handed air. She rests her mouth on his cold cheek, which smells of smoke. Her lips open. She tastes him. You can stay here. Of course you can, but it's too far for you to walk all the way to the hospital from here. Surely they'd give you a bed there. He seizes her and holds her. He is trembling all over. He's stalled with exhaustion and then the shock of the fire and finding everything gone.
All the way I was thinking what I would do if you weren't here.
Where else should I be?
I know, but anything can happen these days. I suppose I could find a cot somewhere at the hospital, but it's so full. We've got patients on the floor, in the corridors, jammed up next to dead bodies.
You can stay here. We'll work everything else out later. Come on in. My father and Kolya are sleeping, but Marina's awake. You wouldn't believe how warm it is now we've got the bujuika. She takes him in and moves her drawing off the arm of her chair. Andrei sits down, closing his eyes. He's staying here, says Anna to Marina. He hasn't anywhere else. His room's been burnt out. Marina nods silently. Then, in the voice that still comes clear from her shrunken mouth, she continues to read from the play.
'Tis time. Descend. Be stone no more. Approach. Strike all that look upon with marvel. Come. I'll fill your grave up. Stir. Nay, come away, bequeath to death your numbness.
Feel in my pocket, says Andrei. Your coat pocket?
Yes.
His coat is cold. She reaches into the pocket and brings out a jar. What is it?
It's for you. It's honeycomb. A patient's mother gave it to me.
Anna takes the jar over to the candle. Sure enough, There it is, a dark comb of patterned cells that drip with honey. There's quite a lot there. The small jar is at least half full. She turns it round so that the light catches it. I wonder where she got it from.
I didn't ask.
You have some of it to keep your energy up.
I get my meals at the hospital. I'm fine. Anna, I can't believe you've got the Borsuika. It's like heaven here. Is it all right if I sleep in this chair?
Of course. She steps over the mattress, sits down at his feet and rests her head against his knees. She feels his hand begin to stroke her hair. His hand is still trembling.
After a few minutes it slackens and weighs heavy.
Marina and her father are within touch, but she feels as distant from them as if she were on another star.
Those stars that hang over Leningrad, bitingly sharp, when the dust and smoke from the shelling clear. They look down, and they see everything.
A smell of antiseptic clings to André.
She knows how carefully he scrubs his hands and arms before he comes to see her, so he won't smell of blood.
"I'll make you tea in a minute," she says.
"Just let's sit."
His voice is blurring. The stove-warmed, people-warmed air is working on him like a drug. His hand on her skin is growing warmer.
"So nice," he says, as he falls into sleep.
Slowly a fog thickens in the little room. The temperature must be at least 8 degrees. Maybe even 10.
She can't put any more wood in the stove, or there'll be none for tomorrow, but it'll be a while before it cools.
They'll have warmth to get them through part of the night. Marina's head has drooped, though she's still sitting upright. Perhaps she's fallen asleep too. How good it is to fall asleep and not to feel hunger any more. You should never wake anyone once they've got away, deep into their dreams, where there's food. But Anna can't sleep. Her stomach hurts, and the candle's nearly burned down. She can think about her drawing. The figures are sharp on the surface of her mind. She can shut her eyes and see them. Who will ever finish drawing all this? The gaping mouths, the heavy coats hung on racks of bones, the shell-shattered streets, the purple faces of old women, the white snow falling, the uncleared snow in the streets, the children scrabbling in piles of rubbish while tongues of ice poke out of the gutters.